Welcome to the official SBGN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Alex Nicely today and Allison Dinning.
Yes.
Mrs. Allison Dinning.
Yes.
Who works as a registered dietitian at Bristol Children's Hospital in the west of England.
That's right.
Your particular interest within the field of dietetics, nutrition, alimentation is, from what I understand, children who have short bowel syndrome.
Yes, I work with many children who need parenteral nutrition, but those that have short bowel have always been a specialist interest of mine. I worked for 10 years on the neonatal intensive care unit. And prior to that, I worked really closely. When I started working in the children's hospital, I was the only dietitian in the hospital. And as a regional...
You're a brave gal.
I was. Oh, yeah. I don't know where that came from, but I worked... The consultant who called on my services and worked most closely with me at that time was the gastroenterologist and one of the surgeons, and we had between us a number of really difficult children with short bowel, and that's always kind of sparked my interest, as you know, as they are a real challenge to meet their nutritional needs, and that's where my interest started, really.
We've seen some amazing changes in how those kids can be not just managed, but helped, I think. There have been all of the surgical approaches to lengthening the bowel, which... And then there's the abject admission of failure of small bowel transplantation. And now there's teduglutamide.
There is. I think that's an amazing and
give us some anecdotes about kids who turned around and flew right.
Flew right. Well, I think the number of children, we have a cohort of about 25 children on parenteral nutrition. And it seems like every year we probably gain two will wean from parenteral nutrition onto enteral autonomy. And I do think that, you know, sometimes even those that you think aren't going to get there very quickly, they do for whatever reason. We've had, I'm just trying to think, this year, probably last year, we had a child who had, I think, about 19 centimetres of short bowel, had... a stoma to start off with. The mother was very, very young, and I don't know how she coped with it, but we have managed to get her onto enteral feeding. She has gastrostomy feeds, but most of her nutrition is oral. And so I think with a young mother who didn't really know anything about cooking or good diet particularly, she's gone to being able to support her child, and the child is now off PN at the age of about 2.5. She came off PN.
Is this attributable to teduglutamide?
No.
Okay.
Sorry, not to teduglutamide. We actually haven't used teduglutide in any patients yet. We're at the process of trying to identify the patients who would benefit from it most. We're putting in place a protocol. It's a big MDT project with consultant gastroenterologist, pharmacy, myself and the nursing team and psychologist, and we just want to get it right and kind of feel we know what we're doing and pick the right patient before we move to actually using it. But we're very nearly there, and hopefully we'll see those children doing well.
I think it's already a substantial accomplishment to have a steady state of 25 patients in your cohort every year, to be able actually to move two patients onward and outward to enteral nutrition alone.
Yeah, it's certainly hard work, but I think the most important thing is the MDT approach. You know, we're all working.
Multidisciplinary team.
Yeah.
Yeah, all working. But you have models from which to learn.
Mm-hmm.
You mustn't reinvent this particular bicycle.
Pardon, sorry.
You mustn't reinvent this particular bicycle. You can just climb aboard a model that's already built and pedal away.
That's right. But you have to have a team that works together, and we're lucky that we have that. But I think a lot of the early work in moving children from parental nutrition to enteral is getting that very good relationship with the family right from the start, getting them on board and working with them. So I think they feel that we're part of their family sometimes, and that really helps.
Yeah, when grandma and mom don't know what to do, then you have to turn out work,
don't
right.
you? I mean, with regard to encouragement of oral feeding and encouragement of food, which I think early starting of weaning of food introduction is really important in this group of children. Many of them, because of the anatomical problems that they may have very little ileum or very little colon, and many of them don't seem to tolerate liquid feeds very well. But now that we've started to use blended feed, for example,
less fluid within the intake, more calories per ounce.
We've seen an improvement in those children. I think that is what we're beginning to do more and more, is the use of blended feeds as opposed to more liquid feeds.
Well, that's clearly an important nutritional strategy.
Mm.
To be used in supporting a baby with short bowel syndrome in the neonatal intensive care unit, moving to blended feeds and providing all sorts of support for the family members as they get ready to take this precious little and so inexpressibly frail bundle home.
I mean, on the neonatal unit, they are so vulnerable, and I think one of... There's so many unanswered questions about how to deal with children with short bowel, and practice varies, as the literature shows, from unit to unit. And it's great to see more, review articles and work being done to try to pull together, consensus on approach. But I think one of the things that we all agree on is that breast milk is absolutely the best thing for these babies, for many reasons, because of the fact that there are factors in growth milk which cannot really be replicated in formula, non-nutritional factors like growth hormones and polyamines,
The biome.
Yes, and the adaptive process itself as well, and increasing helping cause a change in the gut to mean that the child can then absorb food better, and also the microbiome, as you say. I think breast milk works in many ways to help us move these children forward. And also, as you say, the fact that these children are so vulnerable, families are very stressed. It's so lovely to help the mother do something for her baby, really. And I think the psychological benefit of that can't be minimized.
Parenteral alimentation as opposed to enteral alimentation. You attempt, of course, to take them away from parenteral alimentation.
Yes.
And to move them on to enteral alimentation, which can be provided by tube or can be provided by spontaneous child-driven eating and appetite. How do you best like to manage that transition?
Well, I think it has to start from very early on. I think that on the neonatal unit, that approach, and I think on most neonatal units, it will happen. And there's a big emphasis on skin to skin kangaroo care, mm-hmm. and the opportunity for the baby to right next to the mother's skin to skin will help the breast milk supply. And as we've said, that is probably one of the things that we have great consensus on, that it's of real benefit. So kangaroo care, skin to skin, and even maybe prior to the baby being on the neonatal unit and the baby being born, if a child is known to have a problem such as gastroschisis or ileal atresia antenatally, then pulling the mother in to have discussion about the benefit of breast milk even before the baby's born is really important. And I think there are the incidence of gastroschisis is shown to be higher in teenage mothers.
I didn't know that. All right.
And so many of those mothers may not have thought about breastfeeding and not particularly.
No, why would they? It'll all just come along as if by magic and by itself. But that's not how things work.
It's
even
hard work.
Even when you're 16.
Yeah, it is. But if the mothers, in my experience, even young mothers who haven't wanted to breastfeed before have come on board and it's hard work to express and provide enough milk for a baby. Even, though they can't have very much initially, it's still important that they bank that milk for future supply. And many young mothers will come on board with the support that is given on neonatal units. And that's so important. So I think the supporting the supply of breast milk is one of the big things on a neonatal unit, the bonding, the skin to skin. And then I think also the oral experience, trying to allow the child to have that oral experience.
So this is food?
No, with milk.
Well, so this is, it comes to my mouth, it's at my lips.
Yeah.
I can take it in and it won't hurt me.
That's
this
right.
Is food.
Yeah. And it's
not
a
complimentary
pleasurable
food.
It's been associated with, comfort.
This is love.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm almost 70 years old and food is still love.
Yes. And so I think that is so important. I think sometimes we get very number orientated and sometimes that opportunity for the baby to have milk by mouth doesn't happen as soon as it could, mm-hmm. because we're often looking at stoma loss or
just the eyes and nose, the inputs, the outgoes. Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But even if the baby's able to nuzzle or just be around the area where they'll have the smell, and that's the start. And then when the baby is able to start to have milk, hopefully fairly early on, which I think again is shown to help, progression to feeds. Then I think as soon as the baby is able to, that oral experience needs to be encouraged.
And encouraged, speech, reinforced.
Yeah. And speech and language therapists are sometimes few and far between on neonatal units, but in the UK, we're trying to embed the allied health professionals in neonatal teams, and a really important person there would be a speech and language therapist.
Well, those are important nutritional strategies. Some of them are almost collateral, but they clearly contribute to better nutrition, better feeding, better alimentation. And then they leave the hospital, they go home. How do you support them at home with home parenteral nutrition and short bowel?
Well, I think, again, it's about having that good multidisciplinary team. It's a scary time for parents to go home. they will have had a lot of input from the nursing team to ensure that they're safe to go home, and that's impressed on them, and they can be really anxious. So I think, generally speaking, that level of they can phone us when they need to. But I think it's important that they know that if these children are going to move forward and reach enteral autonomy, then food is the way forward. And as I said before, when I was talking about the child with the young mother, I think you have to sometimes teach the young mothers to cook, even not in terms of practical demonstrations, but as a dietitian, I want to provide, you know, really practical advice, not just tell them what to do and give them as much reference, you know, to what to do in real life. So I think sometimes especially with young mothers, they may be part of a family where they, unfortunately these days, many people do rely on convenience foods and they don't know how to cook. And although we're saying food is really important to the progression to enteral autonomy, it does depend on what kind of food is given.
Because from pureed to slightly lumpy to full-on lumpy.
Yeah, but the most important thing is that probably diversity of foodstuff and healthy food, not food that's particularly high in fat or sugar, but good, healthy food, probably what you might think of as vegetables, carbohydrate and protein. And, you know, in the UK, we're fond of our roast dinners, so that's a perfect meal.
Aren't we just?
So that kind of support and advice is really key. So that's probably one thing that will really help once the child's home and help moving them forward. The second thing is that many of these children will have developed some level of food aversion.
Yes.
And again, speech and language therapists can be really helpful. But once the child is in nursery or in school, we feel as a team in Bristol that it's important to really make good contact with nurseries and schools. And it's probably since COVID, actually, one of the good things is that we've been able to communicate much better with outlying services, because if a child is a poor eater at home, they have a level of food aversion, and maybe in a situation where the family aren't used to sitting together to eat a meal, we obviously encourage that. But another place where they can learn to enjoy food is perhaps at school and nursery, and they learn much more from their peers. So we're encouraging schools to give the children that kind of opportunity and support.
Fergus seems to enjoy that. Maybe I'll have some of it.
Yeah, but bringing in the wider teams, the school, the nursery, to support child with food aversion, I think is really important. And actually making sure they have the right approach, because we had one child who we thought that we had engaged the school were helping, and we'd asked the school to perhaps record some detail of what the child was having. But when I spoke to the mother of this child a few months down the line, she said, "Oh, he won't have school dinners anymore." And I said, why?
Yeah.
And she said, because someone in the school was recording what he was eating and overseeing his eating to the extent that he felt so pressurized that he didn't want to even try anymore. So it's about trying to explain to schools and nurseries what the child actually needs.
How to do it as well as what to do.
Yeah.
Oh, what a business.
And then again, the other thing that, as we've already alluded to, that's helping is the use of blended feeds given by gastrostomy mainly. But again, I think it's very important what is given down as a blend is again, it has to be
good food.
Good food, balanced diet. And I think that is the way forward. But I think...
Nobody's going to dump a handful of crisps into a blender.
Well, sometimes people put weird things through a blender. And I think maybe in terms of children, other groups of children who, you know, for example, children with cerebral palsy or neurodisability children, sometimes the parents just want to give the child exactly what they're having, and they will blend weird and wonderful things and peanut butter and, you know, crisps and chips, whatever. But in this group of children, I don't think we know whether all children with short bowel will tolerate blends. Some may tolerate blends better than others, depending on the anatomy that they're left with.
Yes.
And I think there was one study that I found, I think I sent it to you, Alex, which suggested that perhaps there might be a problem with gas production and
cramping,
intolerance, bacterial overgrowth kind of scenario in some children. So I think, you know, we're starting to use blends in our group of children, but I think we have to monitor them closely and work out.
Everybody's dietary program is bespoke.
Yes, different. Absolutely. So I think the advice that's given for maybe those children, other groups of children who are on blends, it may need to be refined a little bit more for those children with short bowel syndrome, dependent on their tolerance. But at the bottom line, the most important thing is good mixed diet.
Thank you. You know, I've been listening, and I'm just not picking up the Scots accent that you ought to have by birthright.
Oh, hi, the new.
Listen to you. I've just been contradicted very, very effectively for those of you who are not native British speakers. Maybe there's a touch of the Scot in the song that you've chosen for us.
Yes.
What is that song, please?
That song is The Mull of Kintyre by Wings.
Oh, lovely.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Thank you for taking part in the Espigan podcast series.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure.